Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to Circumstance. I'm your host, Gina Cafasso. In this episode titled Drawing on Serial Killers, Trauma Unleashed, Aaron Smith and I delve into the intriguing world of ciphers, letters, and phone calls. Our deep dive explores the impact of trauma because, let's face it, most of us navigate life with some form of it. We discuss providing support to trauma victims, coping mechanisms, accepting the healing journey, and the conscious effort required to emerge stronger on the other side. And that's not all. We continue our riveting conversation about Robert Gray Smith's account during his investigation of the Zodiac, the enigmatic Arthur Lee Allen, the chilling case of the Trailside Killer, and more. So talk a little bit about your dad being a witness to that first letter that came to the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, obviously I wasn't there, so I'm retelling, and I probably should know all these details better. But, you know, he was the political cartoonist, or sometimes referred to as editorial cartoonist, but political cartoonist. And he would be in the editorial meetings every morning as all the news was coming in. It was the first thing the editors would do. They'd get together. They'd decide what was the course of the paper going to be for that day. These are the big topics. Get somebody on this story, get somebody on that story. He'd listen in on all that. And then I think he'd usually come up with a few ideas. He may have like three ideas and pitch them. And they go, that's great. Take that and run with this. Or they may give him some notes or something. And then he'd spend the day drawing that thing, which would appear in the paper the next morning. So he was in the editorial meeting when that first letter arrived. And I can't remember the name of the woman that brought it in, but she came in, she brought it down. I think she had opened it and been startled to see this thing. And brought it in, and they looked it over, and they realized, you know, here's somebody claiming about the murders, and, you know, and he was just, I think that was it. I think that's the moment that he got obsessed with it. You know, he'd always been a big, loved detective stories and The Shadow and, you know, Dick Tracy and James Bond and all of those things. And here he was, you know, at the center of this really crazy situation. So I don't know exactly at what point he started. I'm sure it took him a bit to get it out of his head. It wasn't something that was going away. There were so many questions and things revolving around that.
Well, how soon was it from when the first murder happened to when they got that letter? Do you know? Was it like a week later, 2 weeks later, or how long? Do you know what that time frame was, or have a best guess of what that time frame was?
You know, I should know this off the bat, and I'm vague. I want to say it was like 10 days or something, but I'm.
But it was after. I mean, it was a good chunk.
Oh,
of
yeah, it wasn't. He yeah. sent the letter afterwards, definitely. Yeah, yeah. And he described some of the things.
You and I had a conversation outside of this that you were saying that your dad is not a big fan of getting mail or telephone calls. So how ironic is it that, you know, two of the main books he's written are about the Unabomber, another letter sender, and the Zodiac. What can you tell me about that? Why is it that he doesn't like to get mail and phone calls? Like, what's the reason for that?
Yeah, so he's really funny about just kind of stuff that we take for granted for communicating. You know, I'm lucky enough that today he has a cell phone and I can reach him on it and things like that. And it's something he can silence. So it's not like the phone in the room where, you know, it would ring and he just jumped through the ceiling. And I don't know if he was always that way, but when I was a kid, my brother was in an accident. He got hit by a truck and ended up in a coma for about a week, I believe it was. And he's always associated that being startled by the phone with associating it to that, you know, picking up the phone and saying, hey, you know, your son's been hit. So I'm not sure. I always remember. He just is like a wound spring, just ready to pop when that phone comes. So anyhow, so he doesn't always pick up his phone, and he's got this sort of funny thing about mail. You know, he doesn't check his mail. So I always think it's kind of funny. Well, he does check his mail. He doesn't always open his mail, and it's something that he's done as long as I can remember. And I think it's one of these. You know, today just doesn't feel like the right day to open this. You know, if I open this tomorrow, it's gonna be better news kind of thing. And so a lot of times he'll take something, he'll set it away. And he once showed me, he's got a letter from, I don't know if it's from Nixon himself or just the Nixon White House, but it's an unopened letter from the White House from that period and no idea what's in it. He never opened it. He stuck it away in a book somewhere and found it years later. Oh yeah. And he just put it back in the book and it's like, so
he still hasn't opened it. As far as you know, he hasn't opened it.
As far as I know, he hasn't opened it.
And you say that time frame, you mean like during Watergate? Is that what you're referring to? Like it was during that?
Yeah,
time?
Or possibly pre-Watergate.
Pre-Watergate. Okay.
I want to say one of his drawings went to Nixon, but
oh,
I can't. It doesn't seem to make sense to me because I don't think he was painting Nixon in a favorable light. It may have been maybe earlier in his career before he was.
You think
president.
It was a letter? Hey, stop drawing me.
No, I don't know. I don't know what it was. Yeah. I know. Actually, I think when the Watergate break-in was happening, I believe it was the same night as the press correspondents dinner or one of those things. There was something happening because he had ended up, I'm going to say the White House, but I don't know if he was actually at the White House or some other event or some sort of similar event that he was actually at. And, you know, he brings this up a lot like, oh, it's like they had, you know, kind of sequestered all the journalists away while this thing was happening. I don't think that was the case, but I know he's mentioned that a bunch about being there. So there was some sort of thing. I don't know if he got an award or it was just like a larger group gathering or what, but I believe he met Nixon then. I think he once met Nixon at the Chronicle when he was coming through campaigning. And I just remember him talking about the night is like, oh, the waiters are walking around with plates of like, you know, the hors d'oeuvres, but it was like chicken livers and nobody wanted them. He's like, oh, I'll have those. Thank you. So I guess that was something he liked from when he was a kid or something. But so, yeah, he's always had this funny thing with mail. And so I thought it was kind of ironic for him to end up in these, you know, in this arena with the Zodiac and the Unabomber and some of these mm-hmm. people that, you know, their half of their fear campaign is through the mail.
Why do you think that is through the mail? Why do you think? Well, I think the Zodiac, it seems to me like that was maybe one of the only modes of communication at that time. Like, you know, no really computers, no cell phones, no anything like that. Maybe telephone. But well, Unabomber delivered basically bombs through the mail, which is amazing that that happened. But yeah.
Yeah, I think this also because there's a certain level, I think more than a certain level of anonymity, you know. Mm-hmm. And the Unabomber, not only would he mail these things and not put his return address on them or name himself, he would go to another city to mail them. And the return addresses he would do, he'd think, well, if this doesn't make it to my target, I'll just put a second target as the backup. And so if the package got returned, the idea was it would go to somebody else that he wanted to wasn't too happy with. So,
out of curiosity, do you know why he chose his victims? I don't recall. It was a long time ago, but do you know why, what his purpose was or what his thoughts were?
He was very anti-technology. And so, you know, I always got the impression that some of his was maybe a little bit of jealousy and some was a differing of opinions and you're going to ruin the world. And, you know, he has that whole manifesto. And mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, he definitely had some mental issues that he had dealt with, you know, and it just, you know, you can't totally say what someone else is thinking. But
yeah, right.
And he is, you know, each of these guys, you'll find that there are traumatic events that happen to them as children. And, you know, we all have trauma, but at whatever point, you know, he didn't overcome what he had, or he has just some sort of
Well, you know what? I've heard something about people that suffer a trauma at a certain age, that they kind of get stunted at that age. So let's say something happened to them when they were 12 or 13. It's really difficult to get beyond that.
And that's what trauma is. It doesn't necessarily hold you back 100%, but it holds you things attached to that moment, you know. Mm-hmm. You hear about kids that were abused, and usually you hear that it's like some girl that was abused or raped. And you know, when they're older in life and they still talk with a smaller voice, or they're little things. But I think that, you know, with trauma, it's that you there's an inability to process it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be traumatic to you anymore. And it's still there. It's still lingering. And I think I told you a bit that I, you know, through most of COVID, I was spending a lot of time with a friend of mine that had gone through this really awful trauma and had legitimate PTSD. He wasn't shell-shocked or anything like that, but he had experienced a close death, and his reaction to it just stunted him completely. You know, he was stuck in that. It tormented him. He was reliving that moment a lot. And, you know, this was still during the height of COVID. I think it was the second year of COVID, but it was, you know, he was working from home. He was hoping to go back to the office, and he was by himself. And I found, like, well, I'm working from home. I could go over there and, you know, I was editing and doing all these things, and I could just sit in the same room with him. And then, so we'd spend time together. And I found that was really helpful for him, just being able to socialize. And then over that period of time, I think we were lucky that there were things that just naturally kind of came, as far as was able to kind of get him a little more grounded and to a calm space and be able to listen. And when he needed to kind of go down those rabbit holes and deal with that trauma, he was there. But it was an interesting time. It really opened my eyes to a lot of things. And I think we eventually got to a point where I found, like, I could actually consciously calm him down, as opposed to just the a lot of the natural things. But, you know, he'd get into a bad spot, and we found being present. And I think I was telling you before about lead a horse to water. We could talk about ideas,
right,
mindfulness and this and that, that even to me didn't make a lot of sense, but sounded like it might be a promising idea. Mm-hmm. And then I think in practice, it was really helpful when I realized, oh, the things that we're doing that work, are actually, they are those sort of mindfulness things, and not specifically breathing and this and that, but just being aware of, like, being in the moment, being aware of the things around you. And, you know, a lot of times I'd get a phone call from him or something where he's just being tormented, and he's maybe out for a walk, you know, and he's crying, and we'd be on the phone, and I got in this habit. The very first thing I would say was, oh, where are you? And he would stop. Yeah. And I could sense him, like, looking around. He'd be really quiet for a moment. He'd go, I'm at this intersection, this street and across the street from that, and standing on the corner because the light is red, and everything would just come down because they were all these very tangible things.
It's a great approach.
It wasn't processing his trauma, but it was helping getting him into a calm, safe space and just being in that moment, and, you know, not trapped in a loop of these past events. So, you know, a lot of times I'd get over there, you know, earlier in the day, maybe like 10 or 11 or something. We'd hang out for a while and do some work. And then usually, like, we'd make lunch together, but it would just fill the whole day. And then I again and again found myself there till about 9 p.m. or at least till he had run himself down and was, I have to go to bed, you know. But usually our days would sort of end, we'd be sitting on the couch and talking, or maybe we'd try to watch something. But usually we'd end up in this place where he'd be on the left side of the couch and I'd be on the right side of the couch, and realized, oh, that's the space he probably always was in and always would be when we talk about this stuff. Mm-hmm. And as he would talk, he would have these attacks, we call them waves, and where that just everything was coming crashing down on him, and he would talk through, and I would find a lot of things would repeat, you know, he's reliving certain things, or he described things in the same way, or he would make the same quote each time. And I found, as he was experiencing this trauma, my eyes would usually, I'd be looking at him, but they would often divert past him to the right. There was this big Iron Giant poster on the wall, like a bus stop size Iron Giant poster. It was very graphic. And I'd find myself looking at it, and I would see the relationships of the shapes. There's like these jet fighters going in the background. There are these streaks. And every time, that fourth streak doesn't quite line up the same way. I'd find myself thinking that same thought, or the way he's holding the boy in his hand, and like, well, shouldn't the shadow do this? Or, you know. But it'd be the relationships of these shapes. And after I found that I was repeating that again and again as he dealt with his trauma, it occurred to me that years ago, I was in a situation where you know, somebody I was close with, I felt like they were attacking me, you know, verbally challenging me to something, whatever. And I honestly don't remember a word of it until I came out of it. And they said, well, what do you have to say? Like, you know, I couldn't say like, I don't know what you said.
Right.
But yeah, during that, time,
much worse. I'm just saying.
Yeah. As I felt I was being attacked, my brain just went to this place. I was picturing, you know, triangles and squares, just geometry and how things fit together. And it was this very like, and it was a really weird place. And I'd sort of forgotten about it till then. But for whatever reason,
kind of like a coping mechanism in a sense. Like, it's just not necessarily coping, but it's more like something to kind of center you in a way. I mean, that's what it's like to me.
And I think if you tear it down really clearly, these shapes and they fit together and all this stuff. And it's like, there is an order to the world. That's what my brain was telling me. Hey, you don't understand this situation, but here's something that makes sense. Mm. And, you know, after going through this, a lot of the things I've, you know, read and witnessed, and, you know, I'm not a therapist. I haven't gone to medical school or anything. But, you know, my feeling on it is that there's a whole variety of events that happen. And usually when you hear PTSD, you're thinking a soldier or something. And I think now they've changed the name. It's like PTSI or something. They've gotten rid of the D. It's not a disorder. It's there's a stigmatism attached to it, I guess. But the trauma is much more about, I think, how we view the world and how we navigate the world, and that something has come in and disrupted that, and that this very careful structure that we have of how things work doesn't work for us anymore. And until you process through that and create a new image of how the world works, you're going to be in that space. And sometimes you can ignore it. Sometimes you can't. You know, my friend, he's still not through his stuff. He's much, 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 much better. But I think it's still at a level of treatment and maintenance. I don't think he's quite had all that processing yet. Right. And I don't know if he'll ever be completely through it, but at least he's back. He's much more the person I remember before all of that happened.
Well, I'm not a doctor either, obviously, but I find it interesting that some people, like your friend, is working through it, trying to get on the other side of it. You know, he experienced something that traumatized him, but he's working on it to get to the other side. I think some of these people, like the Zodiac and the Unabomber, they can't get to the other side. They're still stuck in that, and they're not moving forward. And they just think like they're almost not owed something, but they feel like that they're misunderstood maybe, or that people don't understand. So I'm just going to do this crazy act so that I get some sort of recognition of some sort. And I hate to say it, but I almost feel like that's kind of part of it too, where they want to be heard. And this is, you know, a way to be heard, whether it's.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I think it's different. A form of, you know, we call it bitterness, but there may be something. You've got something to show somebody, you know? So like, you know, with my dad, even like, you know, we've never talked about it as abuse, but he definitely was, you know, his dad beat him when he was a kid. I don't know how frequent it was or not, but it's come up enough that that's the only, that's the only picture I have to kind of fill the void. I never met any of them, but I know the sort of the ghost that he's chasing and competing with is his dad. He's waiting for people that aren't around anymore to be able to, you know, to show them, look what I did. I won this award, or I wrote this great book, or I did this thing, or I succeeded, you know? And I think the quiet thing there is, it's like, you seemed to think I was going to be a failure or something. You know, you're sort of chasing with that, even though you don't say it out loud. That's the kind of thing, like, I think most trauma that we've internalized to a way, and we all have something. There's something, everybody.
Agreed.
But
agreed.
You don't necessarily go out and kill people or do this or that. But we all have our ways of doing it, whether it's, you know, a generous thing or a mean thing or whatever. It just is, it comes out in the way it comes out. But I know for him, he's waiting for his dad to call and say, hey, I'm proud of you. It's not going to happen.
It's not going
to
happen. Right.
Let alone he's not here to do it. But, right. You know, it doesn't make any logical sense, but you still have that.
Well, wanting that acknowledgement just to know that, you know, for validation, I think is part of it. But I think it's also just getting like, having someone be proud of you, or having someone support you or advocate for you. I think it's also that, like, I feel like if you feel so alone and you don't have anybody to lean on, or any, like, you're helping your friend, which is amazing. You're guiding him through it and helping him and being there for him when he needs you. A lot of people don't have that.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of almost the norm, that most of these serial killers were like loners. Like, didn't have a lot of people around them. I don't know if that's
just no. You know, and most of these, you can kind of date it back and go, oh, they had a very strict mom or very strict dad or something. Like, you used to hear those terms a lot, I think. I don't know if that was meant to be a euphemism or what, but it, for whatever reason, it created I know with, I think both David Carpenter and Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, you know, there are events that I think, at least in the books, that clarify a lot of that stuff. I think there was events that happened to them when they were young that seemed to, you know, to shape them a bit.
And David Carpenter is?
Oh, he's the Trailside Killer. He's still alive. He's up in San Quentin. I think he's 90, 91 or something now.
Wow.
So, yeah. And he had terrorized the Mount Tamalpais. It's like in Marin, like north of San Francisco. And they call it the Sleeping Lady. So the book is named after that. It's the Sleeping Lady's name of the book. But he would come up and find, you know, joggers and hikers and things. And he would wean them off the trail and kill them off the side of the trail somewhere. And then as things started to get kind of thick on that mountain with the police looking for him, he went down towards Santa Cruz and did the same thing down there. Well, you know, one of the interesting things, because I think when we were talking, I keep going back to childhood stuff and kind of how some of this discussion started was, I was up, you know, usually I go up to Berkeley for the holidays or whatever. I grew up there. I don't really have a home up there anymore, but we'll go up and we'll visit and we'll, you know, everybody kind of moved away, but we like to centralize there. And I was driving around with my kids and like, oh, that's the house I grew up in. And oh, look over here. That's the school I went to. And I had this great teacher. And then, oh, later when I took my first school bus, it was here. And I, you know, just kind of going, we go to this park and then slide down that cement slide. And, you know, actually that slide's really great because I got to take my kids there and they got to enjoy
it. Oh, that's cool.
But, but it was interesting. And I can't remember exactly at what stage, at some point, I think we were driving my brother home. We live in Alameda. And as you come through the tube, I don't know if you've been there.
Oh, yeah.
There's the tube. You've got to actually go under the water to get to come out onto the island. And when I was a kid, whenever we were going through that tube, it was because it was the weekend and we were going to go to the Alameda flea market that took place at the drive-in. And that was another one of those, like, oh, this is these amazing, fun things. And we'd walk around for hours and just see all the little, you know, tchotchkes and comic books and collectibles and all that kind of stuff. And then we're driving by. So, you know, now there's like apartments or condos or businesses there or something. But anytime I come out of that tunnel, I still, oh, it should be right there. That's it. That's always been this mental landmark. So we come out of the tunnel, we're going to drop my brother off. And I point over, I go, oh, kids, hey, when I was a kid, we used to go to the flea market here. And I tell them that whole story. And funny enough, one of the guys that stole stuff there had been a suspect in the Zodiac case. And he turned out to be a completely different serial killer. And that was David Carpenter.
Wow.
So, and then I think as I was saying that, I said, yeah, you know, and we used to go to this movie theater. Somehow on that trip, all of these ideas bubbled up. And I would say, like, we go to this movie theater and the projectionist had been a suspect in the case. And we would go to, you know, oh, we drive up to Vallejo, you know, well, there was a playground that we went to in San Francisco. And that's where Zodiac had run off into the, you know.
So it's so, all like all these locations where, yeah, like sightings and things are like suspects lived or worked.
Yeah. And then it was one of those like, well, which came first kind of moments. And I had this weird epiphany of, well, was it just a coincidence that these places were connected? Or did we go to these places because they were connected, you know?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So I'm not sure, and I haven't really... I think I did mention it to my dad at one point. He's like, oh, no. But I still have some doubts.
Like, Dad, come on, be frank.
You know,
with me.
And then I know I was telling you last time about like, oh, as I've been going through, I've been writing a lot of this stuff down. And it's like, I don't know if I have like a solid arc for something, but I just, there's a lot of interesting things because to me, they shape me and I think about them a lot, like going to the movies and all this. And as, when I try to think of the Zodiac stuff, it's tricky because I was so young. I think like, oh, well, that would have been 1976. And it's like, oh, well, no, I can prove that was 1980, you know? So there's this fuzziness. Your sense of time is so different. So, but I've been going back and whenever I'm in the Bay Area, I try to go to the library and I go through the microfilm or microfiche. And I forget which one they had it on. I think it was the microfilm. But I would go through and I'd start looking through all of the newspapers and all that. And I think I mentioned all that before, but
it builds your timeline. Like you're able to go back and retrace your steps in a sense.
And the main thing being that, like, I went through and I, you know, before I talked to too many people, like, you know, asked my brother, what's your recollection of this? Or, you know, my dad or whatever, because I don't want that to recolor. I'm sure there's enough of me, how my memories have probably recolored themselves over time. You know, just each time you remember it probably shifts a little bit. But I found it really interesting to go back and go, well, I remember we saw this movie and then come out and I can nail it down. And same things with that flea market. And, you know, when I think of the cryptograms, I think, oh, that must be like 75, 76 of looking at them. And I may have seen them back then. But I remember specifically one of the places that he lived after he moved to the city. He's only there for about a year, I think, in this one place. But I remember it was when The Incredible Hulk came out on TV. And I know Star Wars had come out because I was opening Star Wars trading cards. So it's this sort of window of, you know, oh, it was this card. It wasn't the green background card. So it had to be during this time. You know, I could probably figure it out to what weekend it was. I think it was the premiere of The Incredible Hulk, or maybe it was when it went from a TV movie to a TV series or something. But it's one of these long, I don't know if you call those Victorians or not, but they were, you know, all over San Francisco.
Aren't they called subway something or other? Anyway, yeah, those kind.
Yeah, those were actually prefab houses. You would order them as a kit, and then everybody kind of got the same house, but as they assemble it, they make a little bit different. But then they would put different ornate things on the house. So, and I don't know if that wood came where that came from, but it would basically you'd order a house and you get this bundle of wood, and it was like, you know, think
wow,
you know, Christmas Eve having to assemble something for your kids.
Yes. It's like, oh, yeah, there's a whole house.
Yeah, and an Allen wrench.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Anyhow, so they lived in that place, and you know, it was like one long hallway. I think they call that like a shotgun hallway or something, and then the rooms I think come off to this side. I think it's something like that. But I remember in the middle, it was this sort of like, it was the kitchen and this dining room, this big dining room table. And I remember sitting there with Dad, and I think it was just this, my memory of the room is always very dark because there's no windows on the sides or anything. There must have been an overhead light or something. But he has all these papers scattered over the table. And he starts going through and he's showing me, oh, well, when Zodiac wrote the cryptogram, it's this. And he had this little key that he had broken everything down to. Look, there's five different symbols for the letter E and all the different things he made it to make it more difficult to be broken, you know?
Now, when your dad started to kind of, because he was working on deciphering them too. So who did he report like his findings to? Did he go back to the newspaper? Was he working directly with the police? I mean, what was his?
So, well, he was working parallel to the police.
Ah.
He got a lot of stuff from them. He'd go up to Vallejo. I think that might have been where he first connected, but I could be wrong there. But he was going up to Vallejo all the time and trying to ask them questions and, oh, we can't show you that. We can't do this. And I think it took him a long time to realize at one point they'd have all this evidence there, or their files or whatever it was. And you go, look, I'm not allowed to talk to you about any of this or show you this stuff. Oh, hey, but I got to go out for a minute and, you know, I'll be back in a bit. And they leave him with all this material. And he didn't seem to get the hint, I guess, that like, I just can't see you do it, but you can go look through that stuff.
Oh, wow.
And so the first time, he said they came back and they looked at him and they realized he hadn't touched anything. He says, I'm going to go get another coffee. And then he realized, oh, right. Okay.
Then he finally caught on. Oh, wow. Yeah.
But so he would go in there and then he would go through these documents and things, but he didn't have cell phones. You couldn't just, you know, unless you had those little Minox cameras where you, like a spy camera, but he didn't have anything like that. He would read as much as he could and he would race out of there and he'd go back to the diner and he would just scribble down everything he could remember, you know?
Oh, wow.
And that would be his starting point for actually being able to find other threads to pull at, you know? Eventually he connected with Dave Toski. And I don't know if he may have met Dave. Dave may have came into the newspaper.
And Dave is a lot of people know who that is. But
yeah, if you saw the movie, that's Mark Ruffalo. Yeah. Dave was sort of a superstar cop at the time. And at this point, he was the homicide. I think he had been, I forget what you call the other department, but he was, I know he would deal with these other kinds of crimes, robberies, and that's probably what it was. But there was, I know, a group of robbers. I think they were called the Human Flies or something like that. And they would sit on top of the elevator. And as the elevator was going up or down, they would stop it between floors, open up the hatch at the top, point a shotgun down and say, give us your money and your jewelry and all that stuff.
Oh, wow.
And nobody would ever see their faces or anything. I think they would lower a bag down or something. So anyhow, so he had broke that case. He broke a bunch of big cases and stuff. And then when Zodiac came around, he was on the homicide squad. And if you don't know, like that, when you're doing the homicide, I think you're on for a week, off for a week, and not off, but you're any call that comes in, any murder, that's your case. I think it's for a full week. And I forget the exact cycle. I think it was weekly, but it may have been a longer thing. So you're picking up all the new cases. And then the following week, you're just focused on investigating those cases. And I'm sure you're doing investigating the other time, but you would get every call that came in would just go to you during that period. Wow. And they would cycle through these teams. And so it was Toski and Armstrong were the team. At the point that Dad connected with Dave, I'm not sure how much Armstrong was around at that point. At some point, he decided to split. So, and that may have been what left a little bit of room. You know, he and Dave became very good friends. And I think to this day, I think he considers Dave the only real friend that he's ever had, you know?
Oh, wow. Did Dave and him come up with the idea of Arthur Lee Allen, or was that your dad on his own? Like, where, how did he become like?
So they kind of both did.
Really?
So Toski and Armstrong had already interviewed Allen. And if you'd seen the movie, that's where they go to the refinery and they see him and he's wearing the watch and you see those shoes. And, you know, like he was the best suspect they had. And I can't remember at the time what it was that they said they had to dismiss him for some reason. And Allen, so I can't quite remember exactly how Dad came on to him, but that was the guy he went through. And like I said, with Dave and Armstrong, they had so much going on. Not only did they have this long list of suspects, you've got people turning themselves in and saying, I'm the Zodiac. My husband's the Zodiac. My uncle is the Zodiac. You know, I mean, you still hear that stuff today.
I was going to say, you're still hearing that today. Like there's so many documentaries right now that I think my uncle was the Zodiac. You know, you're seeing all this. Yeah. It's still a mystery.
And that's another whole thing. Like, you know, I don't think you'll ever be able to say that case is closed. You know, somebody may very well have picked the main suspect, the killer, but you know, it'll never be officially closed unless someone were to find a hard piece of evidence that was, you know, likely would have to be a piece of Paul Stein's shirt with his blood on it. You know, I think that would be the only way to connect and say, hey, we're cleaning out Grandpa's attic. And we found this bloody shirt. I can't think of anything else in there that would have, you know, maybe if one of the guns existed somewhere and you could trail back
or
the
knife, sticks. A knife too, maybe.
Maybe I'm not sure about knives, how well you can match those, but
right.
You know,
or if they find blood traces of any kind on any of these weapons, I mean, possibly still that could still be, you never know now with DNA and, you know, science, it's so crazy what they can do.
And I think in a case like this, you could, they would probably shut the lid on it. I think basically most of them have. They can't officially close it, but they can just stop putting resources to it. And I think that's what San Francisco did. Mm-hmm. I know just before Allen died, they were closing in on him. They were ready to actually, you know, putting a case against him. And then he died. And then I know at some point there was a press conference or something where they kind of said like, yeah, we consider this closed. I don't know if they used those words, but I know there's a point where that was it. They were sort of shutting things down.
Now, was that frustrating for your dad to hear that they're like, it's closed? Or was it just like he put
I think they were
to bed and he was like, okay.
I think he agreed with what they were saying. They're like, they were just basically saying, yeah, we think Alan was the guy and we can't prosecute. You can't prosecute a dead guy.
Dead guy. Right. Right.
You know, and it's something kind of along those lines too. You're talking about the evidence and George Bauert, who was one of the younger guys on it, but played a big role. It was his case for years. He had inherited it from the other guys as they retired. You know, he says, all evidence is circumstantial. Nothing is tangible. I mean, even, you know, you seeing somebody actually stab somebody, that may not be the real story, but ultimately then it has to become testimony in a case and everything is up for deniability. But once a guy's dead, you can't pin the case on him, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't go to court.
Right.
So
the one thing I did want to ask you though, were you ever afraid when your dad got into this? I mean, you were really, really young, so you wouldn't really remember, but as you got older, were you ever afraid for him, afraid for you or your family? Because, you know, I mean, he was chasing a serial killer and he was actually like involved in a lot of investigative things that put himself in danger. Like that one scene in the movie when he's in the basement, like all that.
Yeah,
that freaked me out. That was like the scariest part of the whole movie to me, I have to say.
You know, it's funny because I remember him talking about that, hearing the footsteps above and the floorboards creaking and stuff. But it never occurred to me, you know, it's like, no, of course you're safe. You know, it's probably the way he presented it too. Like, cause us, it was just, it's just normal. This is what we're doing. I think, you know, we both kind of have that same thing where we think we're like a fly on the wall. So it's nobody notices me, you know, and meanwhile, we're driving around in this bright orange rabbit. So it really like me, the sore thumb guy over here. So, but no, I don't think we were really scared. I think only time I had anything that jumped out was, you know, when we would take these trips up to Vallejo and going into the Ace Hardware store. And I remember seeing Alan, he was standing in the aisle with us and he was showing somebody what I remember as a chainsaw, and I'm pretty sure it's not, but I clearly had some notion of the Chainsaw Massacre for some reason. But I think it was probably a hedge trimmer or something. But I remember him holding it in some fashion and like he's talking to this guy. And one of them, I always want to say it's Alan, but I'm not sure. I just remember one of them had a widow's peak, and I, you know, had seen a lot of old Dracula movies and stuff. I associated with Dracula as like, I remember tugging on my dad's arm, like, okay, let's go. So, but
How old were you? Do you remember, recall how old you were?
I think I was probably 9. Oh. So I, in my head, I think I'm 6, but I think when we started going up to Vallejo, I think it was around May of, 1980. Wow. Which makes perfect sense because if I go back to my movie references, it's like, well, let's see, he got divorced for the second time, moved into this new place, and I remember him moving into that place was the around the weekend I think that Empire Strikes Back had come out, or right around that time, because I remember there were no light bulbs in the place, and I remember I had this little Yoda action figure and playing with that. So very right around that time we were going to go see Empire Strikes Back, and we drove downtown and there was just a line of people that wrapped all the way around the block. They had sleeping bags and there's this moment like, well, I don't think we're seeing this movie, and we drove somewhere else and we watched Tony Curtis as the Boston Strangler.
Oh wow, so another serial killer.
Yeah, and I guess that was an older film, but I remember this. We're gonna see Star Wars. Nope,
not gonna happen.
No, so I don't know if that was that same weekend or the week later, because at some point I already knew about Yoda, I guess, when I got that action figure.
Yeah.
So
what was I forget the name of the actor who played the guy who owned that house where he goes into the basement.
Charles Fleischer.
Oh, he's so good.
Yeah.
He plays creepy so good, but he that one line that he says that I know, like you were saying, I don't want to give it away, so you can go ahead and say it.
So yeah, so I know, you know, on set he met Charles Fleischer and just like he's talked so well about it. He's like, oh god, he's such a nice guy, and you know, but he's so creepy in that movie, and you know, so good. But he, whenever we say that line, that good night Mr. Graysmith, you know, he loves it. He's like, oh, I want to have that on my tombstone. So he crossed that off.
So good too. Yeah. Jake Gyllenhaal just like takes off, getting the heck out of Dodge. He's like, oh God, no, I'm not staying here anymore.
Even the camera work in that sequence, it's all locked down. And I think there's this, it's interesting, that little shot, how the camera moves and doesn't move. And
yeah. Because he can't get the key. Like, he's trying to get out the door, and then that hand comes in and unlocks the door. Like, it's like, oh gosh.
Yeah.
That was so creepy to me.
So, and I don't know, you know, we just always talked about all that stuff. So it never seemed, I don't know if it ever seemed scary. And obviously there's really scary, horrible events, you know? I don't know if I talked about this last time, but you know, years and years and years later, they made the movie, but back in the day, I remember he was trying to track down all the people that were, so, you know, the two really hard people to track down were Mike Mugeau, who I don't think he ever spoke with, if I remember correctly. Mike just disappeared.
And who was he? He actually was.
So he was in the car with Darlene Farren when she was murdered. He had been shot. And
oh, yes. Okay,
he was scared for his life. Years later, they found him while they were making the movie. I guess he had popped up on the radar a couple of times, and then he would quickly disappear. And I think he was, I want to say they eventually found him in Vegas, but I think at one point he must have been in LA or something. Brian Hartnell, who was the one, he survived the stabbing at the lake, grew up to be a lawyer. It sounds funny, wow. But he's a lawyer. Right. And I guess he actually ran into Mike at one point in the courthouse.
Oh, wow.
I may be incorrect with some of these details, but just, you know, and he there was something he was talking about. You know, so interesting to see how they were both affected by the same person, you know, talking about trauma. And, mm-hmm. you know, he went this one way where he's helping people. He finds himself on one side of the law, and this other guy in a very similar situation finds himself the other side of the law, just couldn't get out of that that cycle. And there may be other stuff that went into each of them, but with their support and how they dealt with things. But what was interesting was, you know, back in the day, I remember Dad was constantly trying to get a hold of Brian Hartnell. He wanted to interview him and talk to him, and was not having any luck. And then I think finally wore him down. And Brian's like, look, I'm going to talk with you. Stop bugging me. But what was really interesting, it was a name I heard over and over and over again. And really most of the people in that case, other than, you know, I met Dave Toski, but I really didn't meet any of the other guys until they made the movie. So around the time the movie was about to come out, I'd been living in Thailand for about a year, and had come back, and the movie was done. And Mike Medavoy, who was the one of the producers on it, was having I believe it was an engagement party for Brad Fisher, who was his protege, but Brad really produced all the work on the film, all the line producing and stuff.
Oh, wow.
So we went up to Mike Medavoy's house, and it was a very down-to-earth party. It wasn't like Hollywood party, but, mm-hmm. you know, just talking to people. I don't really know anybody there other than my dad and my wife. And I start talking to this guy. He's a really tall guy. He just got a big personality. And he looks like he should be wearing a huge, like, 10-gallon hat. He just, you know, real friendly, and we're talking, and aww. He's talking about my son. He was, I think, about 8 months or 9 months at the time. And he's like, oh, yeah, my son's like 17, or maybe he's a little bit older. And we're just talking, and, you know, and my dad sees us from across the room and comes straight over. He's like, oh, I see you met Brian. And as he says, Brian, I realize who I'm talking to.
Oh, wow.
And it was this weird moment of, like, somebody stepping out of Greek mythology, you know, like Zeus or Apollo, or just something that was larger than life. And he had, you know, that's kind of the impression I'd already gotten from him. He did seem this larger than life guy, but super nice guy, and really neat to see that he had, you know, fared so well in the long run. And actually, if you see the movie, he and his son, I think his son was at the party, because I recognized his son when I saw the movie. They're in the background of the police station at one point. I think Mark Ruffalo is coming down the stairs. They stop for a moment. They're talking on the stairs, I think. But in the background, there's a guy walks by with like a folder or something. And it's Brian Hartnell and his son are back there.
Oh, so they have those cameos.
Pretty
cool. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Well, it is a piece of history too. And they're part of history. I mean, it's cool that they got to take part in that. I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that
he survived that and had a family and was able to get to that point.
Wow.
And especially just to see, you know, I mean, he seems very well adjusted and seemed like a really nice guy. I had a real pleasant time talking with him. So that was just strange.
It's amazing he survived that too, because it wasn't like one or two stabs, right? I mean,
Yeah, it was pretty bad. And, you know, and it's one of those things, I think in the moment, I don't know if surviving seemed like the right thing even, you know, it just seems such a horrible thing to live through and to witness. And
why do you think your dad was maybe took the leap from cartoonist to like almost like an investigative reporter and then later author? Why do you feel like he, like, do you think it just naturally took that leap, or do you think he wanted to figure this out for what? Like for humanity, figure it out for himself? Or, I mean, do you have any sense of that? Like, you know, I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are.
I think it was obsession. You know, really? I'm sure from that first moment, I think he was probably just what started as wide-eyed wonder and curiosity. And curiosity is really understating it. I can't think of a better word than obsession. You know, I think I was saying before, like, oh, I usually use the word focused, but it's obsession.
It's obsession. Okay.
Yeah. He gets very, very focused on what he's working
like
on.
Like the little cough in between there. Focused.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's nothing, you know, else is... You know, I think last time I was telling you about some of the books we're working on, and I'll be going through editing a book that takes place in, say, like, you know, 1939, and he's back in 1850 with the gold rush and the ghost fleet and all that stuff, and I'll have to ask a question. He's like, oh, wait a minute, and he has to. You can see him like taking the train off the track, and slowing down. Like, okay, wait a minute, which one is that? Oh yeah, this and this and this. It takes him a moment to get back out of 1850 and into what life is like at that other point. It's not even just so much the story as like he is a guy that's very comfortable in the older. He always says like, "Oh, it'd have been great in like, you know, the 1400s or something," where it's that level of technology is probably about perfect for him.
Oh wow!
You know, he'll use a felt tip pen or he'll do this or that, but usually when he's doing his illustrations, he's using an old, you know, a nib on a quill and a...
Really? Wow.
You know what you call the stem of that. But take out, you know, he's dipping it in a little ink jar. And that's the way that he's very comfortable with that.
So what do you say when people say or ask if he's the Zodiac? Because you, I mean, that's come up, I know. So what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, it comes up. I think the best answer is probably a non-answer, you know, where you sort of deny it and then you go... But, you know, he wasn't around that 4th of July. No, I don't know. You know, some of that stuff is, I think I told you a little bit about this before, too. I think there's this whole idea of the mastermind theory with all of these guys that, you know, it's this sort of Sherlock Holmes supervillain kind of school of thought where every detail is thought out in advance. And I don't think that's the case in any of these. I think it's, I mean, maybe some cases do, but. Definitely not to that level. I think a lot of these guys are just, they're lucky, you know, that they're Alan. If Alan's the guy, he's super lucky that he wasn't caught. There's so many instances where, you know, George Bauert would say, Detective George Bauert would say, is like, God, if we had had cell phones back then, this case would have been closed in a minute, you know? So, and just that whole sense of communication is a big deal too. When we communicate a lot faster, we don't necessarily communicate better, but we communicate a lot faster nowadays.
Right. Right.
You know,
and also technology in terms of testing and, like, you know, DNA and all. I mean, it's just beyond anything I think that was even a thought back then, you know. I mean, it's definitely changed quite a bit.
Yeah, we have more tools at our disposal and more specific.
Right.
But even then, you know, all you're saying is it's still circumstance.
Mm-hmm. There you go. See.
But no, really, I mean,
my podcast.
Like, well, you know, you find somebody's DNA on something. I'm sure this is happening in court all the time. You know, they say, mm-hmm. Well, just because the blood was on my client's shirt, that doesn't mean that he was actually the one that did it. You know, it just means he came in contact with the shirt. Well, it means his blood came in contact with the shirt. You know, like,
right.
It doesn't, you know, I think there's a level of suspension of disbelief mm-hmm. when it comes to it. Mm-hmm. Just like when we go to the movies, you know,
it's
like, well, this is extremely plausible. Your argument is working for me, you know,
right,
but really
right.
You can deny anything.
Stay tuned for episode 3 in the series Drawing on Serial Killers, coming soon. Thank you for listening to the Circumstance Podcast. I hope you will continue this journey with me as I explore various life circumstances to help inform, inspire, and educate. To hear more episodes, subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram. See you next time on Circumstance.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.